Welcome to Two Men in the Middle, Democracy in Flyover Country. From here, we'll discuss today's topics from a Midwestern perspective with our boots firmly on the ground in a red, kind of almost blue state. I'm Mike McCammon.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And I'm Craig Huey.
This week's topics, pretty much the election.
First midterms.
Yep, midterms. I'll let Craig start because you always do start because you always are prepared and have lots of things to talk about.
So we have Mike back with us this week. Thank you, Mike, for joining us. What you guys didn't see is we just spent 25 minutes trying to get Mike to read the entry there, like old school. And I would say that maybe worked out all right. And we're three dudes sharing two mics tonight. So yeah, when you want to talk, you gotta step up to it.
It's actually 3 men in the middle. I hadn't thought about
that. That's right.
Or as I like to call them, Midwestern three-way.
So that, on that note.
So the election. When we started this podcast in like October of 2017, one goal was let's just get to the midterms. Can we make it to the midterms? I think from a podcast perspective and then just emotionally, mentally, politically, could we survive to get to this 2 year mark of Trump's presidency? And for better or worse, here we are.
Yeah, and surprisingly, the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment are still intact.
Yes, you got to talk about
it. I know. Well, surprisingly, the First and the 14th Amendment are still intact.
What's the 14th Amendment?
Really? You don't know the 14th Amendment?
Come on. Actually, you're a beneficiary of the 14th Amendment. Come on.
Hey, I just got here, all right? The 14th Amendment is... I don't know. It's that one. Well, it can't be too important. It's not in the top 10.
Birthright citizenship.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's been in the news.
Just recently. Slightly.
I should have known that. Okay, so let's get to it. The midterm elections.
Yes.
As a Democrat, I feel like we had a really, really good night. I think we performed as expected. We ended up taking 34, 35 House seats. We held Montana, we flipped Nevada, and we lost 3 seats that I don't think were ever really up for our control.
Well,
anyway.
And Arizona is yet to be determined. That could be a gain.
Yeah.
So in Arizona with McSally and Sinema, there's 16,000 votes roughly separating the two. There's 600,000 outstanding ballots to be counted in Maricopa County and Pima County. So that's Tucson. Yeah. That's Phoenix. And so that could change the dynamic of that race.
So the thing that didn't happen are the three most high-profile Democratic candidates in these midterms, Abrams, Gillum, and Beto O'Rourke. They all lost.
Right.
Just because I don't pay that close attention these days, because I was watching more of the Kansas stuff, that is the senator from Texas, mm-hmm. and the other two are
Georgia,
governor of Georgia, or senator. It's the governor's race in Georgia, right?
Governor's race in Georgia.
And
yeah.
There's also a governor's race in
Florida.
Florida. Okay, those are the three. And all three of those, the Dems came up 0-4 on those. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That is correct. It looks like Georgia's being litigated, though. It looks like maybe headed towards a recount.
Surprise.
You're right. With all we know, with
Georgia's
the,
not headed for a recount. They're headed for a runoff.
Because yes, that's
what Georgia, it is. In the Georgia race, if nobody gets 50%, they go back and do it again.
Ah, that's right. Yeah, thanks for clarifying
awesome.
That.
I love that. How much longer does that keep going on? Do you know?
December 4th.
And let's not forget Florida. The Florida Senate race between Nelson and Scott is also headed towards a recount because right now it's 50.2 to 49.8. And so they're separated by 0.4%, which means automatic recount in the state. And there's still absentee and provisional ballots being counted.
See, at least for me, I mean, I was watching the local races more, and I was not very surprised with what happened in Kansas. I mean, I was disappointed in a lot of ways, but the Dems did about is what they would normally do. I mean, and the candidates that did win really well, I think, were running against such terrible Republicans. It was kind of an easy path. What surprised me the most in the Midwest was Claire McCaskill. I mean, I thought for sure she would have been able to make
and
it.
And it
out.
Wasn't even as close
oh,
as I thought it would
clobbered.
Be. Yeah.
She got clobbered.
So as the longest running Dem here, Mike, you're on Team Dem, but I've been lifelong. You're just off Team Independent to Team Dem.
Mike's a newbie. He's new to the team.
Here's the trap you can't fall into. Somehow Dems thought we could piece back together the Obama coalition and that in one election we could wipe the Republicans off the face of the political map. That's what we really wanted to do. We convinced ourselves that we could get the House, the Senate, we could win every governorship, we could take everything. That wasn't the goal of this election. The goal of this election was, number one, take the House back to provide a check on Trump.
Checks and balances have been lost.
Start a start the and the House now is about investigation, not legislation. So let's get to it. If that's why we want it, and we're going to investigate, open them all at once. Let's go. Floodgates open. Let's get his taxes. Let's you know, whatever we need to do or whatever we think we need to do. Let's do it. But let's also recognize is we really filled up the Democratic bench too. We elected new people to Congress. Congress got younger, more female, browner. A lot of that is on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people we've put in place in Congress that will become senators and candidates down the road. So Democrats should be really, really happy.
The last number I heard, and this is, you know, some race is still in doubt, but 86 women elected to Congress, which I think is all-time record. You'd have to go back.
The number was over 100.
Total. I thought it was over 100.
Okay.
But I mean, the thing that I'm really careful with the coverage because
I think it was 86 new women. I think if you factor in
or something,
like that. Yeah.
I'm really careful with the coverage because when I keep, you know, I kind of check in real quick when I'm in the middle of stuff. And when I see the numbers, I get very skeptical because I know that people want a story to be that, hey, there's this big wave and there's all this change. And I did the math. Like I had saw that the number of Republicans that lost the race was like 10. The number of seats was like 29 in the House. And I'm like, you know, that 29 is not a lot. I mean, there's 435 people in the House. So it's like less than 5%. And like that much of a flip, I mean, yeah, it's important. It's definitely important to have a check on the president. I mean, thank God Congress can't just get railroaded with the Republican agenda. And they'll basically, you know, like when it comes to pre-existing conditions or DACA or anything super effing crazy, at least there'll be a place to, you know, a body that has a majority of people will say no. But in terms of like a big wave, I mean, to me, it was a ripple, I think is what
but
I saw.
I think, Mike, about. You have to keep in mind that there was never going to be as big of a wave as what happened with Republicans in 2010 winning 63 seats or under, you know, Clinton, you know, the number of seats that were won because the seats have been so gerrymandered now. There's so few marginal districts.
Gerrymandering, there was one article, I'm sorry, this one article that made me really angry. And I actually have... I'm going to go after just talking about the First Amendment. Now I'm going to go after Guardian. I actually really love the Guardian. I think they do a really good job of reporting, but I couldn't believe the article I read this. Well, it was just earlier today. And it was about this kind of false like narrative that, well, you know, it was about how the number of votes that got cast, the percentage of votes that got passed and how, why didn't this more people win in the Senate and how it's around the electoral process around Senate seats. And I was just like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, it's, you can't gerrymander a Senate seat. Okay. It's the whole state. I mean, it's already set up that way. So
there's no gerrymandering.
Right. And don't use the fact that now more people live in California and now more people are going to vote in California for their side. And then the D wins. But then now all of a sudden it's just a false narrative. And I got really mad that because it's just promoting a narrative around the fact that the Electoral College is broken, and I understand why all people are mad about it. Hillary had more votes than Trump. I get it. But like, then go change the Constitution. Then let's just not have this kind of ridiculous conversation.
Yeah. So when you look at it, though, on par, and you look at what was able to be achieved, because, again, the Democrats had a tall task because they had to gain a significant national popular vote share to be able to just win those 20-something seats versus if you would have gone back in time, you know, prior to 10 years ago, they could have achieved, you know, something in the realm of 40 to 60 seats with probably half of the total vote percentage. Because of the changes in districting that happened. But the key takeaway here is that all of these seats that turned were suburban districts that factored heavily into Republican majority of the House in 2010, just completely flipping. So you have women, you have independents, you have disaffected moderate Republicans, and, you know, somebody who wants to see more moderates and to see more pragmatists, it's concerning because, ironically, the people that were cast out were those pragmatic governing Republicans.
Correct.
Who are most anti-Trump.
And let me throw this theory out there. The number of seats that we won is irrelevant because Congress, especially the House right now, is not an effective legislative body. And they have no interest in the next 2 years. They will not pass anything. They don't care. I'll go back to Cocaine Mitch's own words. We're not in the legislation business. We're in the personnel business. So the Senate is about confirmation of judges. The House is about investigations. Nobody, and I, argue me out of this point. Nobody has a legislative agenda. Nobody is interested in tackling anything of consequence. So if you won by 23 votes you needed or 250 votes, your majority in the House is irrelevant.
I was jumping for the mic because all I was going to do was poke fun at the fact that you're talking about the personnel business. You're talking about the personnel business, and I assume that means we're going to confirm an attorney general. Is that right?
No. Well, Mike, that's like topic number three. We got to get through this one first.
There's a lot to talk about with that, too.
So, another reason to feel good as a Democrat, moderate suburban Republicans are a thing of the past. They got wiped out in deep red states. They got wiped out all over the place. So you two don't, as moderates, you as a Republican, as a moderate Republican, Brandon, you have no home and you have no place in the Republican
and
Party after Tuesday.
Some of my favorite members of Congress lost. So if you look at Carlos Curbelo in Miami, represented that seat, strong Trump critic, moderate. He's gone. Scott Taylor, Virginia Beach District. There were a couple. Will Hurd in Texas managed to hang on, but barely. But most of them are gone. They either retired already or they were forced out this time around. So what you have is a House Republican caucus that's much more pro-Trump. You have a Senate Republican caucus that is much more pro-Trump because of the retirements that took place. And so that's going to be coupled with...
And a Supreme Court.
And that's going to be coupled with the Democratic majority in the House. So the dynamic there will be really interesting to watch these next 2 years.
Well, and I would argue that the country is what wasn't there some TV show or something called the a country not safe or what's the name of this year pop culture, Craig? A Country Not Safe for Old Men, or it's a movie.
No Country for Old Men. Yeah,
no
plenty.
So this is no country for moderates is what it is, because I feel the same way on the Democrat side.
Yeah.
You know, and what you've seen happen, and this happened even at the state level, the state of Kansas, while there were a couple of swatches of people that, you know, got elected Democrats that were new, a couple R's that got elected new, what really happened, because the net gain in terms of the state legislature in the state of Kansas is about the same R's, D's.
Yeah.
But what happened was that the R's that got elected, the new ones that got elected,
more conservative.
Far more conservative.
Oh, yeah.
So the narrative is actually, it's going to get worse, even though the numbers aren't necessarily that much different.
Well, and unfortunately, you know, for Governor-elect Kelly, that's going to be a problem because she's going to not have as many moderate R's. Because if you look at Johnson County, the Dems picked up about 4 state House seats on par. Overall, and that was by defeating, for the most part, moderate R's. So the most ultra-conservative R's hung on. That doesn't bode well. But I want to jump to Laura Kelly for a second because she did exceed polling in terms of her vote margin. And if you look at that, she won by about 46,000 votes roughly statewide. And 43,000 of those votes... 43,000 came from Johnson County. So Johnson County is what really kind of carried the day for her.
So a lot of Republicans voted for her.
Yes, and Johnson County is a quarter of the state population.
Yeah.
But it also goes to show the urbanization even in a state like Kansas, which has been mostly rural. Because if you look at where Laura Kelly won, she won Sedgwick County, she won Johnson, she won Shawnee, she won Douglas, and Wyandotte. She won the population centers, basically lost everywhere else handily. But that was enough to carry her through, and carry her through by a good 4 or 5 point margin.
So one way to look at this, and I'm stealing this from Steve Schmidt from MSNBC, who said, one way you can look at this as rural America reconfirmed Trumpism. They got redder. They got more conservative. They went more all in. Suburban and urban America repudiated Trump.
Right.
It was clear. Anybody who was suburban America and urban America punished Republicans across the board.
Oh, absolutely.
You guys lost House seats in places that Trump won by 10 to 15 points. So at the end of the day, the red got redder and the blue got bluer.
There's a couple of seats, too, that I want to highlight. So Georgia House 6, so that's suburban Atlanta. So that's Alpharetta, Marietta, Georgia. So the incumbent was Karen Handel, who won a special election after Tom Price was appointed Health and Human Services Secretary. She's the former Secretary of State, ran for governor, and she got defeated. The district next to her almost went Dem as well. Again, suburban Atlanta. Those were two districts that have been longtime Republican strongholds. And then you have Pete Sessions in Texas, Dallas County-based district, includes Irving, part of Dallas proper. He's an 11-term incumbent, former House Republican Campaign Committee chair, House Rules Committee chair. That's the home of George W. Bush. That's his current home, that district. And he lost. Very significant. That wasn't even on anybody's radar.
Well, I know that when you can't spell the word rural without an R.
But you know, this is
actually urban has an R in it too, but I won't.
And I don't think you can undercount this.
So does suburban.
This is
they start with the letter R.
Urban doesn't start with the letter R.
Rural does.
Please, Brandon, talk.
Okay, so you can't undercount the significance, though, of the shift that we're seeing with college-educated metropolitan suburban districts moving towards the Democrats, and that includes those with a college education. So now you have the two parties defined by those with a college education, those without. And we haven't had that makeup before. It used to be Democrats were the party of blue-collar workers. That has changed. The Republican Party is, and the Republican Party is now bleeding educated professionals who are moving en masse to the Democrats. So we have a political realignment happening before our eyes. And the problem, though, for Trump and the Trump Republicans long-term is that the demographic and trend lines are moving towards the suburban metropolitan districts. The rural districts are getting smaller in population.
Yeah, basically, a lot of the folks who would vote for Trump, they're dying off.
Right.
So let's argue a little bit about Beto O'Rourke before we switch over to maybe national lessons learned by both parties in this election. So as we were getting set up and warming up, I went on a rant that Beto O'Rourke, while I like him and I think he is viable perhaps in other places,
presidential?
Not presidential, no, but we spent $79 million to lose a race that everybody thought we were going to lose anyway. At the end of the day, what did Beto O'Rourke actually accomplish? Other than he gave a lot of people good feelings. He's a very articulate guy. As a candidate and as somebody running for office, he has a lot of talent. But if he loses, who is going to win? And what is it next? Is it $100 million to try to take Texas? My point is let states like that go. The amount of resources that were given to Beto O'Rourke, and I get it, he didn't pack money. He raised all of this, you know, small donations at a time. Claire McCaskill could have used a little bit of that. Maybe we could have spread a little bit of that in Florida. Beto did pull some people up ticket, I think, in some of those House districts. But Beto O'Rourke is somebody that I think a lot of people had expectations on. And this is why maybe Democrats feel bad today. Beto O'Rourke was never going to win Texas.
No, and that was always going to be an uphill climb. But getting 47% of the vote in Texas is no small feat. There's no Democrat that's achieved that in the past 20 years.
True. It's still a losing feat. And it helps Democrats realize, even with the perfect candidate in the perfect time and somebody who is as big a douche as Ted Cruz, you still fell
possible.
Short.
It's not but possible. But if you're looking at national candidates who are viable on a national level to take on Trump, you need candidates like Beto who can perform well in places like Texas more than somebody like Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts or somebody like, you know, Cory Booker in New Jersey, who are, you know, geographically and regionally confined.
So I was going to add, so since you're a big fanboy, Craig, so would you take Warren? Would you take Warren or Texas?
Now, wait a minute. You phrased that question very wrongly. So I can have Elizabeth. So let me see if I understand your question. I can have Elizabeth Warren run.
For president, so I'm saying.
I understand what you said.
For the presidential nomination of 2020.
No, what you said was Warren or Texas.
Warren or Texas.
So wait a minute.
Which one you
want?
Wait
a minute. So let me unpack your question because it was asked sloppily.
It's very simple.
No, number one, are you saying am Warren running for president or the field and the field wins Texas? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying I don't remember the guy's name from Texas. Why? That's why I say Texas.
That's Beto O'Rourke.
Beto O'Rourke.
I'm going to go with Beto O'Rourke on that because it might, Mike, if you listen to the podcast about 3 or 4 weeks ago, Brandon and I did a fairly comprehensive segment on Elizabeth Warren, who we basically said for some reason she decided to light herself on fire and throw herself off a bridge.
I didn't see that. So then what about Joe Biden then? Do you want Joe Biden?
No, too old.
Too old.
Too old.
So do you have a runner up then other than the...
What I'm hoping right now is that the 2020 candidate on the Democrat side, we don't know who that person's name is yet.
Sounds like there's an opportunity for you, Craig.
Yeah. Yeah. All I need is to raise like $95 million and we'll get on that.
Actually, all you have to do is loan yourself the money. You don't really have to raise it.
Well, one of the things with Beto is the money. The amount of money that he raised was impressive.
Actually,
it still didn't equate to victory.
The amount of money that gets spent on effing elections altogether is the problem. I mean, I saw the number. It's like $3.5 billion spent on elections. That's just bullshit. That is bullshit. Here's what I did. I'll tell you a quick story. So I got invited to come into the school, my daughter's school, and I talked to one of their government classes. And so I did a little economics exercise. So I talked about, we talked about elections. I talked about a lot of things, but I also talked about money and politics. And I said, so let's assume for a minute, everyone in this room gives me $10.
So you bored the hell out of a bunch of kids.
Well, they did. Only two fell asleep. So I'm good. But anyway, so I asked all the kids, I'm going to give all of you, give me $10, you know, donate me to this election. Now your teacher over here, his name is Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller is going to give me $2,700, you know, to donate to my election. Now, let me ask you a question. In 2 months after I get elected and you call me or Mr. Miller calls me, who am I going to call back first? And every single senior in that room to a word said, Mr. Miller. And I said, what happens if 10 of you call me and Mr. Miller calls me? Which one am I calling back? All of them said, Mr. Miller. And I said, this is the problem in politics. The money in politics is awful. And we've done that. And this is a total, I'm hijacking, total tangent. But the point is the amount of money we spend on elections is ridiculous. And in Texas, it's no different. And in Kansas, it was no different.
No,
and
in Missouri, it's no different. We've had this argument before. In other news, the sun was found to be hot and water was found to be wet.
I want it to be different.
I know you want it to be different. There's no path.
I like summer better than winter, Mike, too. Can we have summer, please?
By your own experience.
I want it back.
By your own experience in the campaign, what was the number one thing that dictated success on the campaign trail?
Money. If you take the race of the Democratic primary and the Kansas third and you sort the candidates by how much money they raised or was spent on their behalf and you compare that to the vote, it's basically run right down the list except for me. I'm the only exception to that rule.
So when
the person
Charisse,
who won had the most money, the person who got the least amount of money was me.
Yep.
And I came in fourth place.
When Charisse David runs again.
David's.
That's what I said.
Oh, they said David.
When she runs again, what's the first thing she's going to do? Secure her PAC money, right? Because
yes,
that's what pushed her over the top the first time, right?
Yes.
So
how likely?
Why are we talking about this?
Okay, we'll continue on. So I baited you on Warren. So you say you hope that we don't know who the candidate is right now.
I'm hoping.
Who's the candidate going to be for the Republican side?
Kasich.
Pence. You think it'll be Pence? Since he'll be the sitting president at that point.
Well, I think. Well, right now, if you're a Democrat, the one getting the most attention is Kamala Harris.
She's pretty cool.
I don't know.
She was the gal that on the Senate. Wasn't she on the Senate committee?
She was.
Yeah.
So awesome. Another big victory for Democrats in the midterm elections was we won the governorships of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. Those are huge.
You might know. What percentage of this by party? The governor's seats. Do you know what it is by state? I mean, is it like 40, 60?
We defended seven and picked up seven on Tuesday.
Democrats have 23 of the seats right now, and Republicans have 26.
Yeah.
That's after a pickup of seven seats on Tuesday, which is huge.
And like what we said, and we've talked about this also locally, is that winning the governor's race is critical in this particular election cycle because of the fact that redistricting happens in the next term of these
absolutely
governors. So by having a governor, I mean it's terrible to say because now let's load the deck so it's favorable to us. But the point is that maybe someone will be reasonable, probably not, and actually try to draw the districts in a more fair way and not have all this gerrymandering, which is another problem.
So Brandon, if you're the Republicans, what did you learn on Tuesday that drives your 2020 strategy?
Well, you know, there's two, I think, opposing paths that happened on Tuesday. So we saw that, you know, statewide, the candidates that tied themselves to Trump managed to hang on. But you get down to a granular level outside of a statewide race that clearly hurt them. The ties to Trump were detrimental. So, you know, I think that Republicans would be smart to look at, you know, Trump and the way that he can possibly help. It's fleeting and it's not going to last. And if anything, it has created a polarized electorate. And if you look at turnout was high, but turnout is going to be even higher for the next presidential election. And that aids Democrats, not Republicans. So, you know, Republicans were able to get their base out as best as they could. But, you know, they should be running scared because, you know, they managed to hang on in the Senate because they had the most favorable map that they've ever had terms of seats that they were defending.
I agree. And to me, that was a trick question. You have no strategy for the next 2 years except you ride Trump to whatever happens.
So this is the party of Trump.
You ride
to
reelection
now,
or you just fall straight off the cliff.
Right. And so what happens to the party after that? It implodes. I mean, it's rebuilt. Something has to happen.
Yeah.
So it would sound to me then the best strategy would be to figure out a way, if you're Republican, is to find a way to get rid of Trump, because that train is heading towards a wall, and if you stay on that train, that's where you're going. If you want to chart a new course, you got to find some other superstar to get behind there, like Marco Rubio or someone like
right.
that.
Right. Well, and I should say there is active talk, and I'm not saying
doing that for Brendan. I know he likes successful. Marco. That's where I was going.
I do like Marco Rubio. I have issues with him, but I like him. But there is active talk of a primary challenger to Trump. Whether or not it's successful, there are Republicans that want to put somebody up.
John Kasich's already basically said, I think he'll do it. And then, yeah, and
Kasich, Jeff Flake has talked about.
And the wild card of that is Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley and Ben Sasse is also someone whose name comes up quite a bit.
Sit down. Sorry, I just had to do that. It was my impersonation of Trump during the press conference. I was telling him to sit down. Will you sit down? Sit down.
Okay, so.
I want to say another interesting wild card, couple things. So Jeff Flake, too, has been to Iowa a couple times, which I think is not coincidental. And he tweeted out just today that he and Senator Coons, you know, they have a little bromance going on, that they are going to unveil legislation next week to protect Bob Mueller.
Well, that's great, Flake. Outstanding. Hey, if you need a sad tweet or somebody to look all hound dog face and upset on cable news, he's your guy. If you want someone to actually pull the stick out of their ass and do something, you look other places. That's what I think of Jeff Flake. I'm so tired of his, aw shucks, we're in such a mess. I wish I could do something. Last time I checked, you're still a senator in the United States. Why don't you do something, Jeff Flake? I hate Jeff Flake.
Ugh. I like Jeff Flake, but beyond that, I'm just going to say...
I'll rephrase. I like the idea of Jeff Flake, somebody who is not going to run anymore, somebody now has the freedom to speak their mind and an ability to make change. That is all great. That's not Jeff Flake. Jeff Flake did nothing.
I will say the only bright spot in the Senate for Republicans, at least if you're a centrist Republican or pragmatic Republican, is Mitt Romney's election in Utah to the Senate, because I think there's a possibility there that you can have a counterpoint to Trump. And if you've been following Mitt Romney since the election, I mean, he's been very critical. So there's that.
So, Mike, from our side, what did Democrats learn from this? And one of the takeaways is maybe progressive candidates are okay in a localized level, but the progressive side really didn't have that good a night, or maybe that's not fair. The progressives that ran didn't win. They may have gotten close. They may have gotten a historical average or exceeded expectations, but none of them won. What do we take away from that?
Well, I do agree with you. I think that, well, in our case, I mean, the progressive didn't even get out of the primary. So they didn't even make it to the general election to run against a Republican. You know, I think that, you know, we talked about, I think in areas where the demographics are such that people find the progressive message and those, you know, primary ones, $15 minimum wage, free college education, and then universal health care, in places where there's high densities of people, I mean, it's almost kind of like you almost need this calculation of like to determine what the political landscape is going to be. You take the per capita number of stoplights per mile. And if it's high, then you're going to be able, the higher it is, the more progressive it'll be. And the lower the stoplights per square mile it is, the more R it is, if that makes any sense. Just because, I mean, when you have a high density of people like that, I think that we got to be really careful that, in New York with that one seat, to me, it was such an outlier. It was just an exception.
It's not representative of the vast majority of seats in the country.
It's not.
And it all goes back. You have to have a candidate that fits the profile and makeup of the district.
Yes.
Where the Democrats did well with the close races that they won, there are a lot of these new first-time candidates, currently representatives-elect, who have military backgrounds. You know, they worked in law enforcement or intelligence. And there, I think there's an all-time high number of those. So those were many of the ones that prevailed were of that background and ilk.
And I think we also learned, too, that the Obama coalition was specific to Obama.
Right.
Because Obama won white women, African American, Latino. He did very good with white men, although he lost them to the Republican side. So far, no one has showed the ability to stitch that back together. And one of the great things as a Democrat we have to get over, we thought Obama basically showed us a path that we were going to win year after year after year because we got all of these different folks to intersect and vote. I think what we're learning is that was something very specific to Barack Obama.
Well, I think also the other thing, I don't know if you'll agree with this, Craig, but I would say that the Democrats did learn, well, they didn't learn this, I think they knew it. It's a lot easier to run against something than it is to run for something. So, I mean, Trump was just, it was so easy.
Yeah.
You know, and then we had this happen in the Kansas third where our representative Kevin Yoder, you know, basically ends up getting aligned with Trump. And yeah, there's just no way escaping that. And so this suburban, you know, population just is finds what Trump does is just awful.
Correct.
That if you tie your representative to that, it doesn't matter who runs against that person. In fact, we talked about that in Democratic primary. Even myself was like, okay, any D we get out on the ticket, if Kevin plays too close to Trump, he's going down.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't, we can put anybody on the ballot. I mean, literally, we could have put anyone, even myself, on the ballot.
We still, as Democrats, have not defined what is our message to America. Why do we deserve your vote?
In a post-Bernie, Hillary, right, Obama world, what's our agenda? What's our agenda for America, if you will, of what we are about?
Why is it important? Why is it urgent for you to vote for a Democrat? We haven't figured that out yet.
And that needs to be defined before 2020, because that's going to be...
It's getting short.
Yeah. Right. And critical for a presidential election. So that's of the utmost importance. You know, I will say, you know, I think if there were some interesting other bright spots of the night for people that kind of follow the kind of nuances of politics. So South Carolina, you had a South Carolina district that was picked up by the Democrat. That was a case where the more moderate Republican was defeating the primary. So Sanford, who used to be the governor of South Carolina,
yeah,
got defeated,
yeah,
by a candidate, Katie Arrington, who ran solely saying she was going to be the most loyal to Trump.
And she,
and
lost.
She got knocked off,
yeah,
in the general.
Where Sanford probably holds that seat.
Yeah. And then Dave Bratt, who knocked off Eric Cantor a couple cycles back,
lost.
He got knocked off this time to a female candidate with a background, I believe, in intelligence. She was a former CIA official.
You know, since you've been in politics for so long, do you think states would ever consider doing open primaries?
Because that
would change this dynamic a lot.
Oh, you can elect moderates then.
Well, the idea is you basically do a runoff. Take whoever wants to run and then take the top four and have them run out and then do ranked choice. And
yeah,
I think they've started doing that.
California, I mean, does. Louisiana does that.
Was it Oregon maybe or Washington?
Yeah, I think
I can't remember
one of those two.
But I mean, if more states did that, I think it would start to solve this problem of the moderate Republican getting defeated in the South Carolina primary and then the ultra-con getting defeated in the general, because the idea is that person,
right,
may not even make it to the general election.
Exactly. And we've seen that does work. I mean, the more moderate candidates get picked to go on in the runoff. We had open primaries in Kansas in the 90s. So that was a thing here. And when conservatives gained control of the governorship and state house, they changed that. Under Bill Graves, we had open primaries. So, you know, we've kind of regressed, really, because that was something we had.
Well, I'll go one past that. We don't need that. What we needed is a European-style parliamentary representation system in this country, because the two parties are getting so far apart from each other, and red is getting redder, blue is getting bluer.
Well, you mean not so much parliamentary as like proportional representation?
Proportional. Is that what I meant to say?
Yeah.
That's what I meant to say.
Proportional representation.
If I'm the free drugs and sex party and I get 10% of somebody the vote, I get 10% representation.
Right. So basically, we have first past the post system or majoritarian, which is basically whoever gets, you know, the majority, the 50%.
Majoritarian. I'm going to use that.
That's an actual term, majoritarian.
I probably won't use it correctly, but I'm going to try to use that.
We have majoritarian districts, first past the post. So we have this. The United Kingdom has this. Canada has this. But most other democracies, Western democracies, have proportional. So you have multiple candidates on a ballot representing all these parties. And then the percentage of the vote overall gets allocated so that so many representatives, based on the overall percentage, get elected to the parliament or the assembly.
Doesn't that sound
so? If the Green Party gets 6% of the votes, they,
yeah,
get to elect maybe two reps out of, you know, 50 or so.
Doesn't that sound a lot better than we have a hardened Republican conservative party? We have a continually radicalized Democrat party. We have a bunch of of third parties in the middle that have never amounted to anything, and our choices just keep being pushed farther and farther to the edge.
And there's a lot of appeal. I think Maine is considering that, or they did pass that recently. I have to go back and check. It was on the ballot in Maine. There was a referendum. I want to say they did pass it, or there's a big push to. And there's been other states that have been thinking about taking that up on a state-by-state level. That's where you're going to see a change.
If states are the laboratory of experimentation, that'd be a really interesting one to do. What are you laughing at, Mike?
I thought you said Maine was a good place to do experimentation. That's why I was laughing.
Maine is not. Maine is not a good place to do experimentation.
That's why I laughed.
All right, so everybody brought a notepad with them today. Let's go over your most important numbers. Mike, you got a piece of paper. Brandon's always got his notes. I've got my phone full of stuff. Let's bust out some number that you thought was so compelling that you copied it down. So I'll go first. This is one from Twitter. Turnout by voters 65 plus surged on Tuesday. What percentage of the overall electorate was made up by people 65 and over in the midterms, national average?
I'm going to go with 27%.
26.
Ooh,
26. Close. That is up from the last three midterms of 19, 21, and 22. Wow. So I get it. The young people did better this time. Oldie still votes very consistently.
Speaking of the young people,
And by the way, most of those people are white.
Speaking of the young people, so Republicans got the smallest percentage of the youth vote than they have, than even in 2008, which was their low
point. Everyone's leaving the young Republicans. Just want to let you know that.
How did they get any? How did anybody under 30 vote for Republican?
I do want to make one point, though. I mean, I'm going to pony. I have a statistic I want to say, but I have to
go for it.
Whatever, tag along with you. I did see a statistic that 18 to 24 year olds, only 13% of them did vote. So it may be the fact that the problem is that maybe it's not that there are no young Republicans. It's just it's hard to count them because we can't find them.
Okay. So going along with that, but speaking of the youth vote, the highest turnout of the youth vote was in 2008, and even then it was only 56%, but that was considered monumental because that was the most up until that time. So another fun number, if you don't believe that every vote counts, Florida, governor's race, Monroe County, so that's southwest Florida and includes the Florida Keys. So the vote in that county alone is 50-50, one vote separating the candidates out of 36,000 cast.
That's cool. All right. Well, my number has nothing to do with what you just talked about. It's all these scribbles here. What I was doing is I was taking a look at all the major offices statewide and then congressional races in the state of Kansas. And other than Laura Kelly and Sharice Davids in the Kansas 3rd, every single one of the other ones, no one broke 46% on the DC. They all lost. The Secretary of State lost, Attorney General, Treasurer, Insurance, first, second, and fourth. And all of them lost pretty badly. And when I look at it, you know, we were talking about this big blue wave, and it seems like maybe it really was like you were talking about earlier. It may have just been a Johnson County phenomena that basically affected those two races the most that allow those two candidates to actually win. Whereas even like you said, like Paul Davis in the second, who was running against a terrible candidate.
Awful candidate.
Terrible candidate. Still lost, which is just amazing.
Which is shocking. Yeah, I think the blue wave stopped at Johnson County. It is interesting, though, that in Johnson County, the Dems that were running statewide for treasurer, for secretary of state, which one am I leaving off?
Treasurer.
State insurance and attorney general and governor.
So they three of those four they won in Johnson County. Insurance commissioner Vicky Schmidt won, who's a moderate Republican, with 52%. But that's unique because typically Johnson County Democratic candidates for statewide lose in those other offices. So you have this trending of Johnson County into purple/blue territory, but it did mirror the rest of the state. But it does tell you if you're running as a Republican in Johnson County, you have to be aware of the changing demographics because they are changing. They're changing very rapidly. Four pickups in the state house for Dems, which brings them up to 9 possible reps total out of the legislative delegation from Johnson County, which is an all-time high. Net total, they did not move the needle. In fact, Republicans west and south were able to hold onto their seats. So in the legislature, Governor-elect Kelly is going to still be dealing with a very Republican legislature, and not only very Republican, very conservative, because so many of those moderates that she would need for coalition building have been knocked off.
So here's one. Democrats won 18 of 20 House seats in districts that voted for Trump, that Trump won by 5 points or less. So across the board, if Trump barely beat Clinton, if it was one of those suburban districts or there were Trump triers, hey, I just can't vote for Hillary because of whatever, I'm going to try this. Almost universally, those folks did not vote for, they got beat.
That sounds about right. I have a number to attach to that. So there is only one congressional district left in America that Hillary won that is still represented by a Republican after Tuesday, and that's out in California. Just one left.
Holy mackerel. Well, I can say anecdotally of the people that I know that live in Johnson County that I know, that, well, they told me they did vote for Trump because they did not like Hillary Clinton, had the same visceral reaction around Kevin Kobach. So, I mean, they were independents or Republicans, and they did vote for Trump in the last cycle for president, and they were not going to vote for Chris Kobach for governor. There was just no way.
Right. And I think, you know, I think those of you that follow Kansas politics would know that the dislike for Kobach is so strong in Kansas. And let's be honest, he has never won Johnson County in any of his statewide races for Secretary of State. But he's also never lost it by as much as he did on Tuesday night.
Yeah. So the one that I'll end with is Florida restored the voting rights to 1.4 million felons. Florida is this weird, goofy, nobody can consistently figure out what's going to happen in Florida.
Right.
Now you dump that is the biggest increase in voters in the state of Florida, I believe, since like the Civil Rights Act. This is,
and I don't know if you can know where felons are going to go.
Oh, we know where. But this is, come on, the vast majority of those are voting for the Democratic Party.
Maybe.
Really? These aren't 1.4 million white collar criminals. All I'm saying is, Florida has always been a little bit of a mixed bag. There's just one more element that makes Florida.
It adds to that uncertainty, yeah.
Absolutely. And if Florida is shut down to Republicans, your path gets extremely difficult to the White House.
Right. But hold on. I mean, that's considering that the vast majority of them are going to be regular voters or have been. I mean, we don't know what their voting propensity is either.
But in elections as close as Florida has been, 200,000 votes is huge, can swing one way or the other.
It is. And I always caution people that want to say, oh, Florida's Republican or trending Republican. It's still a 50-50 state. These elections prove that. I mean, so split down the middle. If you look at Trump's win in Florida by one percentage point, I mean, you cannot get closer than Florida has been for the past several election cycles in every race.
I said the Civil Rights Act. I meant the Voter Rights Act. I got the wrong one. Another piece of Democratic legislation that, you know, has stood the test of time is something we should be proud of.
Yeah, they'll give Trump any ideas, so you may want to.
This is back when we decided we needed to pass laws and adopt policy and legislation that actually meant something and affected people's day-to-day lives. It's been years since, as Americans, we've had that expectation.
That was a bygone era, yeah.
of our Congress, and I don't think this midterm election changed anything. Nobody made a single vote on a policy issue. You voted because you were pissed, because you were mad, because you wanted somebody to be checked, or you wanted to send someone a message. Does anybody think gun control, which again, nice, we had another mass shooting today, which doesn't even bear talking about, but do we think that anything is going to change? No. That's what I'm saying. When you were running for Congress, you were running for the least impactful job in the United States.
Thanks, Greg. And no, I think that, yeah, and for me, what was most sad is that, and I told the high schoolers yesterday, you know, I told them that if you run for office, you have to come up with your platform, your policies. But I also did tell them that at the end of the day, you know, a lot of what makes this thing work is money. And like, it doesn't really matter what your policies were. I mean, like, I don't think most voters that you could talk to that voted just this week could probably tell you what the top four issues are.
Nor do they care.
Of the candidate they voted
for. Nor do they care.
Which they should. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing, sending people.
Why are you blaming the victim? The victims here are the people who you're asking for my vote when you haven't done anything of substance as a body. And I'm pointing this at the House and the Senate in decades.
Well, and not only that, but then most of the TV ads that these candidates run are negative against the
absolutely
other candidate.
You're a
and
crook,
they're never
I'm a
talking
crook
about like what the hell they're going to do.
Because, but that's the cat that's gotten out of the bag, Mike. They're not going to do anything, right? Nobody even sets an expectation that I'm going to Washington
I'm sorry,
to try to do something. That's my aggravation point. We all know the fix is in. You know what's going to happen for 2 years? Nothing. Well, We're just going to sit around and fight.
I tend to agree with that because there's no good reason to actually for people to come together right now, because everyone was pissed about what was going on and they wanted to send a message. And so now we have gridlock and we're going to be stuck here.
And the fireballs that we're throwing at each other now are big ones. Gun control, abortion.
Yeah. And
immigration. Right? We're not even saying let's find little things to start to build some trust back with each other. All we're saying is I disagree with you on this core message. We can never talk again. Okay, great.
Yeah, it is. You forgot healthcare because that's another intractable one as well.
Cocaine Mitch came out today and said, yeah, we need to do some bipartisan work on healthcare. Well, really?
Yeah, well, really? There's what they try to get. There's what they do for the cameras and there's what they actually do. And those are usually two different things.
3 weeks, I said, right now, if you're a new member of Congress and you're reaching across the aisle, better be to double up a fist and punch somebody. And that's where we're at.
So I had a conversation, I won't say who it was with, and I may have told this story before the audience. So if I have, I'm going to apologize beforehand. But, I was told that if you go to Congress, freshman member of Congress, mm-hmm. one of 435, you're not going to get anything accomplished. You're going to come back, you're going to do nothing. I mean, you're just going to get nothing done.
I firmly believe that.
And I said, I disagree with that.
Yep.
I said that in that position, you are the ultimate convener. You could actually have conversations, at least in the district, about issues that matter to people and actually maybe get something done. Maybe get something done locally about immigration. Maybe get something done locally about housing or healthcare or issues that like really matter to people and at least have a conversation to get things moving.
I just haven't seen it. And I can't cite any examples. Well, I don't
think
anyone's going to do
that because I don't think many people that get elected have that kind of way of thinking.
No.
They've got stars in their eyes. They're going to run to D.C. and we may see them as often as we see our current representatives, which is virtually never. And like, that's just total bullshit.
97% of Senate of the time, senator gets reelected.
Right. So
I've got my PAC money behind me.
Right.
What do we care?
And the PAC money is a bit. Well, I won't go on that big rant, but the PAC money is a big deal. I mean, I sat in meetings. I'm not going to go there. But money's the big problem.
But I'll steal one of your lines. If I get there, all I have to be is a coward, and there's a 97% chance.
Absolutely.
I get to go back.
That's right.
All I have to do is not take a stand on anything, and there's a chance I go back. A 97% chance I go back. What's the point? What are we arguing about at this point?
Well, and that's incentivized by the process and the setup, especially in the House, because you're up for re-election every 2 years, which means you, as soon as you get elected, you immediately have to start fundraising for your next election. So you spend that 2 years fundraising, which makes you less likely to take positions and may put you, in conflict with core constituencies. And so it perpetuates this cycle that just goes on and on and on, and nothing changes.
So now that I've explained to everybody why our legislative system sucks and needs to change, let's move on to the executive branch. So Trump, I will give him credit for this. He spent 3 weeks at a nonstop pace campaigning for the Senate. He let the House go because I think he realized that was one thing. But the man did put the time in and he does put the work in. He managed to cut these things down from 90 minutes of rambling to 45 minutes of somewhat telepromptered. He boosted his lying quotient up. I think he went from like 8 a day they were tracking to like 35. And he went from little to big to whopper to unreasonable to mythical tax cut. He did everything he could to impact the election positively for Republicans.
Right.
And under no circumstances can you not say it wasn't effective.
It was. And I thought you were about to say somewhat unintelligible, and I was going to disagree with you because I don't think he's intelligible at all.
That's just a given. That's a given.
But I think, too, you have to, and I hate to go back, but I think the Kavanaugh hearings played a role in motivating base Republican turnout in some of these key
states.
I think
you're right.
I think that's when you saw the polls start to change, and some of the Democrats in these states lost their leads, and these states became hyper-competitive at that point. And so you have to look back and say, strategically, tactically, was this the best time to do this fight when long-term, the impact it would have?
Yeah, see, my take was that basically Trump was throwing anything he could on the wall, as controversial as he could find, to basically get people to move off of the Kavanaugh hearings. Because if he didn't do something, it was just going to continue to linger. And I actually think that I don't necessarily agree that it actually helped. Maybe I didn't see the same polls, but I thought it really energized the Democratic base, the way that kind of whole thing went down after he got confirmed.
Well, yes, but it also energized the Republican base. And polling has shown that Supreme Court nominations are a big motivator to conservative Republicans, that will bring them out to vote no matter what.
And
if
you
they
couldn't,
feel the Supreme Court
you couldn't
is on
poke
line.
The female bear anymore. Right. They were already on fire against Trump anyway. There was nothing more left to motivate through the Kavanaugh hearing.
I think at that point they were going to turn out anyway.
Absolutely. But 95% of African American women were going to vote for Beto O'Rourke. Period.
If you go back to 2016, Trump's most base appeal for those who were not comfortable with him was, I will give you Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. You may not like me. You may not like anything about me. You may not like anything I'm proposing, but I will give you the Supreme Court.
And then Mitch McConnell is culpable in that because he comes out and says, we will not take up a single piece of legislation that is not endorsed by Donald Trump, and we are in the personnel business.
Right.
That is the unholy alliance between those two that have helped put us to where we are.
Yeah, they've worked in tandem.
Mike?
It's awful. What am I supposed to say? It's, by the way, if you hear
how
these gaps,
disagree with me?
No, I can't disagree with you, Craig. You know, I feel like a guest tonight. You know, usually, you know, back in the days when I was a co-host, I could spar with you. You know, I could take us on these far off tangents about Little Debbies and all kinds of fun stuff.
But now
I'm just a guest. It's kind of hot in here. I'm just trying to like make sure that I contribute a little bit. So maybe I'll get invited back again one more time.
It's kind of like you're at a friend's house. So you don't want to reach into the refrigerator and grab something without asking.
Yes, that's very true.
And this time you hear is Mike and I walking back and forth to the microphone. Maybe we should spring for a third mic.
I was just going to say, when are you guys going to get some advertisers to spring for a third mic?
We need sponsors, to take care of that.
So I left off in a rant on McConnell and Trump and how those two have really fed off of each other. Let's get to press conference. Once again, Trump has normalized moronic behavior out of the presidency of the United States. And I don't say that lightly. I don't like calling the president of the United States a moron or an imbecile. But at some point, those are the only two words that describe him. And what I think happened is somebody finally explained to him what happened Tuesday night and what that means for him going forward over the next 2 years.
Right.
And where I will give Trump credit, I think Trump said, I'm not going to sit here and die death by 1,000 cuts from the Democratic House. I'm not giving you my tax returns. You're not looking at my business. You're not coming at my kids. So you know what? Let's strap it on. I'm going to play my cards. You play yours. Let's see who wins. And I think from that press conference to firing sessions, he just said, let's speed this up. If you want me, here I am. I'm not going anywhere. I'm a known. Let's go.
But it's classic Trump trying to change a narrative from losses in the House to a different story. And he doesn't want to take responsibility. We knew he wouldn't take responsibility or say, hey, we messed up.
He called out people who lost because they didn't embrace him enough.
Right.
who does that?
Well, there was a story out there from Politico saying that he was completely tone deaf about the predicament in the House until like late September, because again, he lives in this bubble where he goes to these rallies and believes that these, you know, crowds are indicative of, you know, the state as a whole and of America as a whole, and that he just refused to accept that there was any opposition out there that was significant to him, and he's just completely, you know, closed off to that. And so he can't come to accept that now. So it's deflect and change the narrative.
So that press conference was another 60 plus minutes of rambling, incoherent nonsense. This one had the middle point where him and Acosta, I don't like Jim Acosta. I think he's just kind of douchey. I get it. You're CNN and you're smart and all of that. Trump's an a-hole. I understand all of that. I don't need you to explain that to me. Ask a question, sit down. And
right.
Trump, yes, he is still the president of the United States, and in the hierarchy, he is more important than you, Jim Acosta, and I know that drives you nuts. But you're not going to get into some debate over him lying at these random, rambling press conferences.
No, it's not going to be effective, and what are you going to accomplish by that? You're not going to get him to admit to anything, and instead, it gets him all riled up, and it makes a reporter, in that case, the news story, and it takes the focus off the actual news and what the issues that
should be discussed. I was offended by when he talked about, you know, that one question being racist, and how when the Asian reporter asked a question, he said he couldn't understand them.
Yeah.
I mean, it just yeah, it was basically like taking down people, like on a personal level, just so he could stand there and just grandiosely be like, I'm Mr.
And
President.
If he doesn't want to answer the question, awful. That's fine. But it's too just how rude he is. And I mean, you know, yelling reporters down and just, you know, the dialogue.
How about
it,
this?
It's not something we've ever
seen.
If you
don't like Jim Acosta, don't call on him. Don't let him answer any questions. It's pretty easy to do.
But I bet he calls on him for the very purpose that he knows
doing that. I agree with
that. That's going to happen. So that way, I mean, he knows it's going to happen. And so that way he can go after him, and they can have that whole exchange. And now that'll be what everyone talks about for the next week.
But it gets his base worked up too, because he can say, "See, here's the evil
fake
media,
news,
the enemy of the people." He'll go down that tangent again.
So, Mike, we're already sitting at like 56 minutes, which I know that makes your skin crawl. So, in the last 5 minutes here, what does the Sessions firing mean? What can we expect out of that? And you know, we all knew this was coming.
I don't really have an opinion. I mean, I think that, like you said, we knew it was going to come. I mean, you have to believe. I mean, I've always held the view that no matter what Mueller finds, at the very end of the day, whoever gets caught is going to get pardoned anyway. I mean, it's for entertainment value at this point. I don't think anyone's going to ever go to jail or going to get impeached or anything like that at all.
I think it's interesting, and the only thing that could crack Trump's base a little, or has the potential to, is direct Russian involvement in collusion.
And they're never going to be able to prove that.
I think it's very unlikely that happens.
Yeah, I just because it seems like there's been enough information that shows that, you know, it's plausible. But proof is different than plausibility. There you go.
And hey, did you know that Trump got most of his money from his dad, who hid a bunch of tax shelters and gave him a bunch of money?
You know, it's just it has always been remarkable to me that rural America, which by the way is largely urban, I mean rural poverty. I mean, most of the people that live in, I mean, you go any place 50 miles west of here or 100 miles west of here, I mean, these people are struggling economically.
Yeah.
And the fact that they would give a rich millionaire like him the pass of like, it just confounds me to this day that he was able to whip them up and get them to like him and believe him that, you know, he's a good, upstanding person. He was going to look out for them. It's just, it's like no one in the state of Kansas ever trusts anyone from New York City. Like that is just a known rule. And how that happened in rural America, I just don't understand. But I guess there's a lot of things I don't understand in this world, and that's one of them.
Tucker Carlson said something really interesting the other night. He was on Ben Shapiro's show, and I don't like Tucker Carlson. Carlson is
not a fan.
Butthole. But he basically said, you don't have to know anything else to know this country, how systemically that we have such systemic wrong problems, to know we elected Donald Trump. That's all you have to know, that the country is fundamentally broken in so many areas that we elected Donald Trump. He's like, you don't have to study anything else. You don't have to look at any other data sets. In this country, that man got elected. That is enough evidence that we have core issues that go beyond maybe typically what we deal with as Americans.
Right. And we keep the focus on Trump and, you know, but what does that say about us? What does that say about us as Americans and as a country that's who we elected? I mean, we can be appalled and ashamed all we want, but what does it say about what we respond to and what our base instincts are and where we are, you know, and the, you know, plotting the course of this country long term, where that, what he represents resonates and it continues to resonate for groups of people.
And he feels no shame. He just double and triple and goes to the well again and again and again.
Right. And nothing sticks to him.
Nothing. And it's not drying up. He's like a comic who's been on the road for 2 years with the exact same material. He hasn't changed one bit.
I think it does demonstrate, and I think the election demonstrated this to me too, is that we have become an entertainment society. You know, if we are entertained, then, you know, we'll pay attention. And as you know, as I was there are moments on the campaign trail that I was remembering from the movie Gladiator where Russell Crowe's
character, Are you not entertained? Yeah.
Are you not entertained? And it's just like, and it is the rule of the mob. And I've written about this previously that I think that the way news is curated online today, particularly with the way Google News and all these websites work, is they serve up the news that gets clicked on the most. So you're more likely to see the news that, you know, people want to read as opposed to the ones that might be more interested or nuanced. And so it really is the rule of the mob. It is not necessarily the rule of the electorate. It's the people that show up and make noise about it.
So we're into the third act of the Trump presidency. There was the first 2 years where we kind of figured out what type of president is he going to be? What is his legislative agenda? Does he make this pivot towards presidential, traditional presidential behavior? All of those questions have been answered.
Let me give you a metaphor. How about we look at the Trump presidency, the 4 years? What every year is a season. So there was the spring where it was
all
new.
You're messing up my metaphor. I'm mid metaphor and you jump on the mic and you change the metaphor. I'm not telling mine. Go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say there's the springtime where it's all new and it's all fresh. Then the summer is the second year. That's when you're harvesting all your
life. Okay. That's not
now it's the fall.
No.
Okay. Now it's when it all comes. Okay.
That metaphor sucks.
Okay.
So there was the first 2 years like I was trying to explain.
That's not a metaphor.
Well, analogy. This is an analogy, okay? You know what I meant.
Metaphor analogies are kind of the same thing.
Just, there's the first 2 years, and if I'm not explaining it again because you've already heard me. Shut up and just listen. Then there's the midpoint where the first referendum. Do we like you? Do we not like you? Do we want to continue kind of, do we believe in the direction of your country that's going? Now we're into the third act with the last 2 years, which is, now going to be the Mueller phase.
It sounds like you're doing a screenplay, not like a metaphor. I just want to let you know that.
So that's all I got, Brandon. Do you have anything to finish up with so Mike can't talk anymore?
I was just reminded of when I heard Colin Powell speak a couple weeks ago, and he was lamenting the state of the Congress and the fact you have a Congress has abdicated their duties, and something we're likely to see for the foreseeable future. He said the problem is that Congress members are influenced by the echo chambers of cable television and online media. And
that is see the new attorney general.
Exactly. And I think that directly addresses that. I mean, that's where we are in America.
Yeah. That's our hour. I think we kind of hit some highs, hit some lows. There were some good points. There were some depressing points. And Mike, I mean, we have to wait till another major election to have you back. So we'll see what happens.
I was going to read this last little bit from, I had to find it real quick. Oh my gosh.
If you're going to read me the definition of a metaphor, I'm shutting your mic off.
No, I'm not. I'm actually going to read, this is great. So this is how I closed one of my blog posts a while ago. It's one of my favorite lines from the movie Gladiator. And it's not just how are you entertained, but it's like, it goes like this. Rome is the mob. Conjure magic for them and they'll be distracted. Take away their freedom and they'll still roar. The beating heart of Rome is not the marble of the Senate. It's the sand of the Colosseum.
So the sand of the Colosseum here is what in America?
The sand of the Colosseum is the mainstream media. It's the thing that we consume all the time. It's CNN. It's Google News. It's all of that. It's the roar. It's if you entertain the mob,
I agree.
Then you are in charge.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, again, it's not the marble of the Senate where it's decided is actually with the mob. And it's, I don't mean, that sounds very, very pessimistic, and I'm not that pessimistic. Because I had hoped that people could appeal, that you could appeal to people's rational thought.
Yeah.
That they would wake up and say, you know what? What we see right now, I'm looking at this right now and I think it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I want to participate in fixing it. And there were people that were like that. And there still are people like that. But sadly, there was not as many of those people as I thought there would be.
There's just too many people that want to fight right now.
Yeah, one statistic. I don't know, again, if I told you this in the last time I was on here. We did a survey right after the poll, right after our primary, about a week after. And it was very representative of the way people voted. So it was people that voted for me or voted for the other candidates. 65% of people made their decision in the last week of the primary.
When all the PAC money had come in.
So basically, if you're not paying a bunch of money for TV and a lot of money for direct mail, you are a unknown candidate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so And that's why you have to go to Texas and spend that kind of money.
Yeah.
Is because otherwise people won't know who you are, even if it's just a two-person race, because most people are eating their Taco Bell and doing things at Gladiator. And they're just not, they're entertaining themselves.
They have other things to do.
And just to make fun of ourselves, we've also made politics almost entertainment of it itself.
It's the best show going.
Exactly.
It's the best show going. There's nothing better than this.
It's great reality television.
Absolutely.
It's almost as good as Patrick Mahomes. Can we do a whole episode about Patrick Mahomes?
Brandon and I have said multiple times, we're SNL writers. I come to you with a skit, and you're like, that's so unbelievable, we can't write that. I'm like, you're right. That's like everything happening every week.
Yeah.
You can't write it. All right, that's our hour.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast, and be sure to subscribe through your favorite store. Visit our website, the2minutethemiddle.com, for historical episodes and more about the podcast. Likewise, you can find us on Twitter at the2minutethemiddle for show updates and upcoming episodes. Thanks for stopping by, and have a great week.